Wahino am Adonai Eloheinu Aleinu Ma'asedeinu Kununa Aleinu Ma'asedeinu Kununehu. Shalom, welcome everybody. We're now going to be continuing in our Shiurim in Sefer Daniel. We are beginning in the seventh chapter, the seventh perek, which now shifts into an entirely different structure and mode that the Sefer had up until now. For the first six chapters of the Sefer, we were learning, if you will, history. Daniel's relationship with the kings of Babel, and later, of course, of Paras and Medai. His interrelationships with them. And we learned tremendous, profound lessons, visions of the kings. Now, our orientation shifts to Daniel's visions themselves. As we will see in these parakim, Daniel is going to describe to us his dreams. His dreams are very vivid dreaming. They're very lucid dreaming. In our previous lessons, we've discussed the manner and method of lucid dreaming. As it says clearly in the Torah, Hashem speaks to a Navi through visions of the night. It is while we sleep at night that our brain shifts into different modes of brainwave activity from the normal waking state of beta brainwaves, they call them, down to what they call delta or theta brainwaves. It is in that other form of consciousness that Hashem speaks to us. We have learned from this that the entities on the other side of reality, who do not exist in our physical dimension, but in a dimension of their own, communicate through delta and theta wave brainwaves. This is the method that they communicate with us. As such, the mode, the method, the technique of the communication is different from that which we know as our rational waking state of consciousness. When we are communicating in a state of consciousness, we do so more through words. In other words, we form sound through the five places of pronunciation, our lips, our teeth, our tongue, etc. And we form different sounds which represent different concepts and ideas, which are understandable only to those who understand the same formations of sound. In other words, language. And languages shift between peoples, races, countries, nations, history, times, generations, centuries, etc. Therefore, language is not a very efficient way of communication. But there is a much better way to communicate, and that is through image. An image, a picture, means much, much more than just the word used to represent it. For example, if I say the word spelled with the letters A-P-P-L-E, you know it means apple. Those of you who know English will all of a sudden think of a red or a green apple, how crunchy or tasty it could be, how juicy and delicious, etc. Whereas, for those who don't know the language, the word means absolutely nothing and no image comes to mind. Whereas if I show you the image of an apple, anyone who's ever had an experience with the fruit, regardless of the language in which it has a name, the apple and the experience which it represents is understood. And so it is with the entities which we call spiritual. Communicate with us through the ways and means of imagery, picture language, in the words of psychology, archetypes. And it is imperative upon us to endeavor to understand the meaning and message of these archetypes. Or, as it's written in the Gemara Masechet Berachot, a dream uninterpreted is like a letter unread. And indeed, the imagery that we will now learn from Daniel's dreams needed to be interpreted for him to understand, because they were so obscure that he needed some assistance to help it become concrete in his mind. But even so, it was clear from those communicating to him, they stated, Daniel, not everything is meant to be clear. Remember that. And you might say, well, gee, why not? Some things are concealed. And you might ask, why? Why must there be secrets? Some might say to you, oh, you are not worthy to know. Well, what is the concept of worthiness in relationship to certain knowledge? Especially if it's enlightenment drawing close to God. Well, gee, should everybody know that? Doesn't it defeat the purpose that knowledge essential to draw close to God shouldn't be known? So obviously, that is not what it's here for. Indeed, there is great knowledge in the world that if people wish access to, they can have. Whereas there's other knowledge wherein which people cannot have. The Zohar HaKadosh teaches us that a blessing only rests upon that which is concealed. Because that which is revealed and exposed to all is subject to, if you will, a rigidity and a crystallization which cannot be changed. Understand now, as will become clear through Daniel's visions, not everything in prophecy is written in blood, as they say, is as hard as a brick or strong as a rock. Prophecy, by definition, is fluid. We're going to learn now in these visions of Daniel plans that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has set in motion for the Jewish people, for mankind. And we will learn that they themselves are fluid. You see, HaKadosh Baruch Hu set a course of action for the Jewish people when he set us free out of Egypt with Moshe Rabbeinu and brought us to Har Sinai to receive his Torah. The whole purpose of Hashem's involvement with us is that we as a race, yes, Jew and Gentile, all of us as the descendants of Adam, can rise up in a experience of enlightenment and wisdom to know the truth of God. In the words of the true new covenant as spoken by Yirmiyahu, when the Mashiach will come, that the Torah will be written in the heart of the Jewish people. No longer will everyone have to say, know Hashem, for they will all know me. Pray that day should come ever so soon. But that is our purpose. If the Bnei Israel did not sin with the golden calf, Moshe Rabbeinu would have been Mashiach at that time. And the Torah which he had brought down from Sinai would have gone to the world. And human history would have taken a greater and different course. It did not happen. Hashem set Plan B into motion. Centuries later, the Holy Temple was built. The Ark was placed within. The Shekhinah came down. And we had a great opportunity to shine the light of Torah. But again, we fell short. And again, HaKadosh Baruch Hu had to, if you will, chart another course for us, as our temple was destroyed, as we were sent to exile in Babel. And now, as the time of the ingatherings are to come, Daniel is shown a vision for yet another plan that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is setting into motion for the sake of the rectification of the sins of the Jewish people, for the sake of the elevation of his Torah and his light, that it truly can fulfill the nevuah, the prophecy is spoken through Yeshayahu, that we should be a light to the nations, to ultimately and inevitably bring the true Mashiach. Here we are now with Daniel. In the days of the twilight of the kings of Babel. And Daniel is given a vision of that which is to come in years to come. In essence, what Hashem's new plan is for that which is to be. And we will learn about this plan as we proceed and see what has come about from it and what yet has shifted because of the sins of the Jewish people. In Daniel 7, we read, in the first year of Belshazzar, the king of Babel, Daniel saw a dream, and the visions of his mind as he slept in his bed. He wrote his dream down and said the beginnings of the matters. Daniel raised his voice, and obviously he's now sharing this with those close to him. Apparently, it is understood from this that Daniel was sharing this with those people who would eventually become what we call the Anashei Knesset Gedolah, the men of the Great Assembly, those who would be responsible for the rebuilding of Klal Yisrael, passing on the Torah, etc. I saw in my vision during the night, and behold, the four winds of the heavens were stirring up the great sea. And four huge beasts were coming up out of the sea, each one different from the other. These four beasts, very similar, as we will see, to the dream that Nebuchadnezzar had about the great statue of four different parts. The first beast was like a lion, and it had wings of an eagle, until its wings were plucked, and it was taken from the earth, and it stood on feet like a man, and the heart of a mortal was given it. As all commentaries agree, this first beast that comes out is like a lion, as it says, with the wings of an eagle. For those of you who are familiar with archaeology, the image of an angel called a charuv, or in English a cherub, was very well known in Babylon. It was not the image of a little child, but rather it had the body of a lion with the wings of an eagle, with a human face with a long beard. You can see statue images of this in any museum that has ancient Babylonian statues. They are prominently displayed in the Louvre, in Paris, and I'm sure in many other places around the world. This is the image that Daniel saw and was very prominent in ancient Babel, because these were their lowercase g gods. Daniel recognized this as the image of Babel, and saw that its wings were plucked, and that its heart of a lion was taken away and given a heart of a man. Now you might say, well, the heart of man is not a bad thing, but our sages understood that this is actually a symbol of weakness. But then again, in light of Nebuchadnezzar's revelation about the truth of God, maybe that's also what it means. But that too led to his demise. Babel was overcome, defeated in military battle by its neighbor to the east, Paras, Persia. So indeed, the modern-day warfare between Iraq and Iran only shadows the ancient war between Babel and Paras. In essence, these two nations and their spiritual source have been warring with one another for centuries. Daniel continues and says, and behold, another second beast resembling a bear, and it stood to one side, and there were three ribs in its mouth between its teeth. And so did they say to it, get up, eat much meat. Now, this second beast is said to be the coming empire of the Persians, here represented as a bear. The Persians were known for their opulence and their wealth. And that's what it means when they say, get up and eat much meat, that they would indeed become great and wealthy. As we learn from the story of Queen Esther, which happened a generation or so after this, that King Ahasuerus ruled over an empire of 127 nations from Africa through India. A very large and affluent empire. These three ribs in its mouth is subject to interpretation. Most commentaries refer to it as three individual city-states, which were always in a constant state of a rebellion against Persian authority. Others interpret it as the three major kings of Paras, who was Cyrus, Ahasuerus, and Darius. Which one is it? Well, this is one of those interesting things about prophecy and dreams. Most likely, it is both and something else unknown or unrecorded to us. Because this is the wonder of a dream, or if you will, a vision. It does not have a limited one-time, one-meaning definition. It is one of those fluid things that have multiple definitions. Just like Rabbi Yochanan said in the Gemara Berachot, that he had a dream and he went to a number of different professional dream interpreters in Yerushalayim in his day, that each one of them interpreted his dream differently, and that each interpretation came true. So we learn a dream follows its interpretation. So indeed, when it comes to understanding prophecy, the application applied to it becomes its fulfillment, which is the real reason why, as we will see, many things in Daniel are concealed, so no application can be applied to it. The meanings are nebulous. If we were to apply this vision as a psychological mode and to interpret it within the character of what the four empires mean psychologically, we would understand them as being an application, if you will, to different elements of alienation within the psyche, different ways and means a person can be incongruent with themselves. And therefore, we can apply all of these different interpretations to individual and personal psychological applications, which are as accurate and true as the historical applications that they meant immediately to Daniel. Again, the greatness and wisdom of prophecy is its ability to be fluid and to contain all of these different meanings. After this, Daniel says, I saw and behold another one, a third beast, like a leopard. And it had four wings of a bird on its back, and the beast had four heads, and dominion was given it. This beast is said to be a reference to the Greek Empire. The Greek Empire, who conquered the Persians, had the swiftness of a leopard and could fly almost like an eagle with four wings on its back. That's how quickly Alexander was able to conquer practically the entire known world in his young years. And upon his death at the ripe old age of 32, the four heads was the division of his kingdom amongst his four generals. And dominion was given it. Now here's an interesting term. Shalatinya hevle. Understand now the rise and fall of politics of nations is ordained in accordance to a preset plan. While we all praise our ability of free will has a boundary and parameter of limitation to the self, but not necessarily to the circumstances revolving ourselves. Nations, their rise and their falls, all follow in accordance to, if you will, a plan, a play, a script. Shakespeare wisely said, all the world is but a stage, and we are but players thereon. And indeed, no wiser words can be said. Because whatever nation rises, whatever nation falls, It is in accordance to that which is written in the book. There's a script going on. There is a process going on behind the scenes. And so when great and mighty nations rise, even Nebuchadnezzar, who led to the destruction of the holy temple and the murder of possibly a million Jewish people, one of our first Holocausts, it was by divine design. God allowed, ordained, controlled, and directed Nebuchadnezzar to do this as he guided the Persians to overcome the Babylonian Empire, as he guided the Greeks under Alexander to conquer the world, all by design with a purpose behind it. And you could scratch your head and go, well, what is that purpose? And that purpose, as I said, is to test you on a personal basis. We cannot control those things which happen to us on a daily basis. One can be the most holy, most righteous, most pious individual around, Talmid Chacham, study Torah, do great mitzvot, Maasim Tovim, and still bad things happen. Still bad things happen. Case in point of what goes on in Eretz Yisrael today, the Holocaust in Germany. Bad things indeed do happen to good people. And you can shake your head and go, tisk, tisk, you know, mazal, it's from Hashem, or whatever it is. Yes, that's true. But when bad things do happen to good people, it is for a reason. And that reason is not so much to punish us, but if you will, to test us, to give us the opportunity to respond. So when bad things happen, rather than respond negatively, meaning to surrender to evil, if we are to rise up and resist evil and overcome it, then shall we be successful. And you might say, well, gee, what is God's ordained will? God's ordained will is revealed to us clearly in His Torah. One need only to study these lessons of the lives of David HaMelech and how he addressed adversity. Shimshon, Devorah, Eliyahu HaNavi, Daniel, Ish Chamudot. These are why these lessons are here, to educate us, to help us understand that when we are up against a dominion, how to respond to it in such a way which properly brings what we call Kiddush Hashem, sanctifying God's name. The fourth beast. After this, Daniel says, I saw in a vision of the night, and behold, a fourth beast. Awesome, dreadful, and exceedingly strong. And it had a huge iron teeth. It ate and crushed and trampled the rest with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before me, and it had 10 horns. I looked at these horns, and behold, another small horn came up among them, and 3 of the first horns were plucked out before it. And behold, eyes like human eyes were on this horn, and a mouth speaking arrogantly. Before we discuss what happens to this horn, let's attempt to identify it. The fourth beast is traditionally always defined and identified as the next empire who took over after the Greeks, Rome. Rome was known for its power to crush and destroy, symbolic of iron teeth. Trampled everything under its feet, devoured it, symbolic of eating. It was different from all the other beasts before it. This beast had 10 horns. According to some interpretations, Ramban, for example, Kampi Pshat, defines this as a reference to the 10 emperors of the Roman Empire, from Julius Caesar all the way through Vespasian, who reigned up until the time of the destruction of the Holy Temple. But yet, in order to truly understand this, we must look at it from the light of the secret teachings of the Kabbalah. This great and mighty beast It said it had a small horn that came up from among them and had eyes like human eyes. This is here a secret that is taught to us in the writings of the Kabbalah. I must not digress to help you understand the very, very important Kabbalistic principle about the creation, if you will, of evil. As we know, God is revealed to us in the universe through the manifestation of his divine light, which we understand as how it is revealed to us. It is revealed to us, if you will, by certain polarities, certain energy vortexes. In Hebrew, we call these sephirot. And the sephirot are 10 in number. And they properly reflect, if you will, if you allow me to use the word, the, in quotes, personality of God, his mochin, mind, and midot attributes. Indeed, the sephirot are traditionally referred to as God's attributes. Prior to the manifestation of these 10 sephirot or attributes of the divine in creation, there was an initial emanation of these attributes. In the language of the Kabbalists, they state that these attributes, as they emanated, as they manifested, did not properly interact with one another, and therefore emanated a state of imbalance in the primordial universe. Specifically, the language of the Kabbalists is that the initial light came into the vessel. The vessel itself was not able to receive the light, and the vessel shattered and fell. This, of course, is called the teachings of the Shavirat HaKilim, the breaking of the vessels. And indeed, the vessels fell. It was called the world of points, or, as the Arizal teaches us, they emanated from the world of what was referred to as the eyes. What those eyes are and why it's referred to is that we don't have to get into those details now. I discussed those in my lessons of Kabbalah, my basic concepts and terminology series. It's available to you on tape through koshertorah.com. Here, let's understand Daniel's vision, because by looking at this beast, he is seeing the reality of these primordial vessels, this initial emanation, which due to its state of imbalance became the source of evil. These 10 horns that rose upon this great beast were indeed the 10 fallen sephirot. 7 fallen, 3 upper blemished, if you wish to be precise. And indeed, we see a reference even to that. I looked at these horns, and behold, another small horn came up among them. And 3 of the first horns were plucked out before it, meaning uprooted and taken away. Those 3 horns, of course, are a reference to the previous 3 empires of Babel, Paras, and Yavan, Greece, which the Romans, of course, completely usurped. So it was here that this final kingdom would overcome them all. And a small horn that rose up from the emanation of this place called the eyes. The eyes were on the horn. And the horn, again, is a symbol. Okay? It's a symbol, a reference of something of power. Like the horn of a ram is a symbol of its power. So this is the symbol therein. It had a mouth speaking arrogantly. Now then, it does not take much insight and revelation for us to recognize what small horn could come out of this great fourth kingdom of Rome with enough power to overcome and neutralize the cultural and social situations of the previous 3 empires. Of course, militarily, politically, they ceased to exist. So when it says they were uprooted, it's only within the context, if you will, of their religion, their culture, their society. The small horn with eyes that spoke arrogantly is a reference to that which would come out of Rome, which we know today as the church. Speaking arrogantly against God. We'll read more about this as we continue. The ninth pasuk states, I was looking until thrones were set up, and the Ancient of Days sat. The Ancient of Days is a very significant and important Kabbalistic metaphor corresponding to the highest emanation of the Sefirot called Keter, the divine will. Here, Daniel is saying that the thrones were set up, meaning the manifestation of Keter, the ultimate divine will, is now to become manifest. When something is about to become manifest, we say it sits. In other words, it comes from above to below, the metaphor of sitting. Its raiment was as white as snow. In other words, pure. White actually is a symbol of mercy, outgoingness. The hair of his head was like clean wool. His throne were sparks of fire. It had wheels of burning fire. Wheels just like the chariot vision as seen by Ezekiel. Now, there is a very profound secret here, because the level of Keter, the highest of the Sefirot, is of a sublime and high level, a level of which that not even Moshe Rabbeinu saw in full. How then is it that we can apply, or Daniel can have such a vision? And the answer is we must understand it within the context of Daniel's vision. In the world, in the realm of the Kabbalah, we speak of different levels, different dimensions. They're referred to as the Arba'a Olamot, the four worlds: Atzilut, Beria, Yetzirah, and Asiyah. Atzilut is the realm of God, Beria the realm of souls, Yetzirah the realm of angels, and Asiyah the realm of time and space. Each of these realms has a revelation, or if you will, manifestation of the tenth Sefirot within them. Daniel only saw to the realm of time and space. The angels with whom he interacted came to him in this realm and revealed to Daniel the secrets behind the workings of space and time. They did not show him the upper realms and the angelic planes themselves. Those were visions left to the domain of greater prophets than he. And that is why to this day the book of Daniel is not included amongst the second layer of the Tanakh, the prophets, but rather the third, called the writings. Daniel was not considered a prophet because the entities came and revealed to him things here. He did not, in essence, ascend. The river of fire was flowing and emerging from before the Ancient of Days, and a thousand thousands served him, and tens of thousands arose before him. Justice was established. The books were opened. The great day of Hashem, spoken of by the prophet Malachi, is here foreseen. I saw then from the sound of the arrogant words that the horn spoke. I looked until the beast was slain and its body was destroyed and given to a flame of fire. But as for the other beasts, the dominion was removed. They were given an extension of life until a set time. Here we see that this horn speaking arrogant words was slain, its body destroyed and given over to flames of fire, which speaks that indeed the final and fourth kingdom of Rome and that which comes forth from it is destined to be destroyed in a flood of fire, as the days of Noah was destroyed by a flood of water. and the other beasts are by this neutralized. They have an extension of life as ordained above. For a time. A time. A nebulous definition. We don't know how long a time is. And again, that's one of those unclear things, because a time can be made longer or shorter, all based upon the divine plan, of which we do not know. Daniel continues and said, I saw in visions of the night, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, one like a man was coming, and he came up to the Ancient of Days, and was brought before him. All commentators agree that this one coming with the clouds of heaven is the son of David, the true king of Israel. And the Ancient of Days gave him dominion and glory and a kingdom, and all peoples, nations, and tongues shall serve him, and his dominion is an eternal dominion, which will not be removed. And his kingdom is one which will not be destroyed. My spirit, I, Daniel, became troubled within its sheath, meaning its body. And the visions of my mind terrified me. Wouldn't it terrify you to recognize, to see the course of human history, of the great things that are going to come, the wars that are going to come, the suffering, the trials, the travail, recognizing that things will not be as easy as we would like them to be? In his dream, Daniel says, I drew near to one of those standing there, and I asked him the truth of all this, and he told it to me, and let me know the interpretation of these matters. He said, these huge beasts which are four kingdoms which will arise on the earth, and the high holy ones receive the kingdom, B'nai Yisrael, led by the angels, who, as in the Sefer Zechariah predicted, would come with Mashiach to impose order upon the earth. They will inherit the kingdom forever, to all eternity. And then I wish to determine the truth of this fourth beast, Daniel said, which is different from them all. Excessively dreadful, teeth of iron, nails of copper, eaten, crushed to powder, and the rest it trampled with its feet. And concerning these 10 horns that were on its head, the other one that came up, and the three that fell before it, the horn that was like this, that had eyes and a mouth speaking arrogantly, and its appearance was greater than that of its companions. Who is this horn? I looked, and the horn that was like this waged war against the holy ones, against the Jewish people, and overwhelmed them. Who is this horn? Until the Ancient of Days came and gave revenge to the high holy ones. The time arrived that the holy ones inherited the kingdom. The holy ones we know is Israel. Who is the horn? And so he said, the fourth beast represents a fourth kingdom that will be on the earth, which will be different from all kingdoms. It will devour the whole land and trample it and crush it. And the 10 kings that sprout from that kingdom represent 10 kings that will arise, the kings who reigned in the land of Edom before there was a king in Israel. A subtle suggestion, a reference to the spiritual source of the evil, which manifested itself physically in the 10 Roman emperors who ruled from Julius Caesar to Vespasian prior to the destruction of the temple. And the last one will rise after them will be different from the first, and he will humble 3 kings. Remember, kings here is not necessarily an individual, but if you will, a culture and a society that is represented by the metaphor king. And this horn will speak words against the Most High. He will oppress the high holy ones, the Jewish people, and he will think to change the times and the laws. Who is this horn? They will be delivered into his hand for a time, 2 times, and a half a time. I read those words with tears, because no one knows how long that time will be. But you should know and recognize the identity of that horn without me ever having to tell you. It is clear and evident. The arrogant one, the blaspheming one, the one who tries to speak against times, to change the Shabbat from its holy day to a Sunday, to change the law by say you are not under law, you're under grace. The horn is Yeshu, the church. The Christian should know and recognize that that which they embrace is none other than the Antichrist whom they fear. That is something we Jews have always known. Daniel saw this, that little horn that rose up. This is Yeshu. This is the church. There is no distinction and separation between the two. They are one and the same. Fruit does not fall far from the tree. Fruit is still part of the tree. The church is part of Yeshu. We know who he was, which is why our sages would have nothing to do with him. According to our history, he was not executed by the Romans on a cross or anything of the kind. Even the Muslims in the Quran know that that was not true. We have a completely different story. To try to align the historical records between Jews and Christians, in my opinion, will never be accomplished and never should be. I actually feel a pain in my heart because I know so many good, God-fearing, sincere Christian people who have received a hollow inheritance for so many centuries and have absolutely no idea and no ability to accept the truth of Daniel's vision because of the images and the pictures burned and etched and stamped into their minds for so many centuries. But yet we have an obligation to tell the truth. And I am obligated to say that. As Daniel continues, he says, "And the judgment shall be established, and they will remove his dominion to be destroyed and annihilated until the end. And the kingdom and the dominion and the greatness of the kingdoms under all the heavens will be given to the people of the high holy ones, the people of the angels, the Jewish people, a kingdom and perpetual kingdom, and all dominions will serve and obey it. Until here is the end of the matter. As for me, Daniel, my thoughts terrified me greatly, and my colors changed upon me, and I kept the matter in my heart." Daniel foresaw that which was to come. He foresaw the suffering, the domination of the Jewish people. He foresaw that which we know all too well. Moving right along, in the eighth parak, Daniel has now another vision, another teaching, another insight into the great kingdoms that is to come. And indeed, he's going to reveal to us some very profound matters here about the natures of that which was to come upon him. In the third year of Belshazzar's kingdom, chapter 8 begins, "A vision appeared to me, I, Daniel, afterward appeared to me." And here we have an interesting little shift, just for the note, for record, that the language now changes back from Aramaic to Hebrew. "Afterward appeared to me in the beginning. In his vision," he says, "came to pass, and I was in Shushan, the capital, which is in the province of Elam. And I saw in the vision that I was beside the river Ulai." Now, it's interesting that he states this, because was he physically in the city of Shushan, or was he somewhere else and in his vision in the capital city Shushan? Well, this is a disagreement amongst the sages who interpret Daniel. But apparently, those who hold this to have been a vision seem to be more accurate than not, because the river Ulai did not pass by the city Shushan. It was similar as saying that here I am in the city of Chicago overlooking the Mississippi River. You might want to scratch your head and say, well, gee, the two are kind of like 100 or so miles apart. I said, well, in a vision, it can be any which way that the vision shows. But now, it's a vision. Let's accept it as such. Daniel sees water in his vision, just like Yechezkel was by a river in his vision, as a secret component to the metaphysical, metaphorical image of water. I lifted my eyes, Daniel saw, and behold, a ram was standing before the river. It had horns, remember, symbols of authority. And the horns were high, and one was higher than the other. And the higher one sprouted last. This is a metaphor for you again, Will. Two, as we will see, the leaders of Paras and Medai. Remember, those are two kingdoms that merged together. Well, they had two leaders who merged together. I saw the ram goring west and north and south, and no beast could stand before it, and no one could save anyone from its hand. It did according to its will, and it grew the Persian Empire. And I was pondering, and behold, a he-goat came from out of the west over the surface of the entire earth, Greece, Alexander. And it did not touch the ground. And the goat had a conspicuous horn between its eyes. Again, a symbol of Alexander. Before I proceed, let me digress for a little bit. As we know, Alexander from Greece marched upon Eretz Israel. The sages welcomed Alexander, led by Shimon HaTzadik, the high priest of the time, a man of great awe and great presence. Alexander was actually overwhelmed by Shimon, and due to his impression of the man, spared the city and did not subject it to battle. In honor of Alexander, people from that day began to name their Jewish children Alexander. And to this day you will find many a Rav having the name Alexander. One of the most famous, of course, was one of the Komarno Rebbes of the Safran family, Rabbi Alexander Safran. Alexander had in his army his teachers, philosophers. According to legend, even Aristotle was with him, who is said learned from the sages of the Jewish people. You could scratch your head and say, why would he do that? Because according to our teachings, as outlined in Rabbi Menashe ben Israel's Sefer Nishmat Chaim, that even Plato and Pythagoras, years before, were students of the biblical prophets Ezekiel and Jeremiah. And that there's been a long history of connection between the Jewish people and the Greeks. And therefore, when Alexander came to the Jewish people who were already rebuilding the temple, there was no war, but a welcome. Alexander's great battles were to the east, when he defeated Persia. And the record of these battles is recorded and well known in military history. Continuing now, Daniel's vision. And it came to the horned ram that I saw standing before the river, the goat did. It ran toward him with its fury of power. And I saw it coming up to the ram, and it fought with it, and it struck the ram and broke both of its horns, Paras and Medai. And the ram had no strength to stand before it. So it cast it to the ground and trampled it. There was no one to save the ram from the hands of the goat. The he-goat waxed exceedingly huge, and when it became strong, the great horn broke, Alexander. And the appearance of four sprouted in its stead, to the four directions of the heavens. This is the breakup of Alexander's empire. In the west, north, which was under the Syrian and Babylonian rule, the Anatoxus, you had the Ptolemies in Egypt, and you had the Eastern Empire east of that. So there were four different places where Alexander's empire was divided, symbolized by these horns. And from one of them emerged a small horn, became very great to the south and to the east, to the coveted land. From the north rose to the south. This is a prophecy of Anatoxus, the one who imposed the Greek culture upon the Jewish people in the days after Alexander, which led ultimately to the Maccabean Wars. And it says here, and it grew until the host of heaven, and it cast down some of the host and the stars and trampled them. This is in reference, of course, to the oppression of the Jewish people during this time. Until the prince of the host, it grew. And through him, the daily sacrifice was removed, and the base of his sanctuary was cast down. A reference, a prophecy, to that which the Greeks would do to the Holy Temple, to endeavor to remove the high priest, here referred to as Tsaratsava, or if you will, the prince of the army. Indeed, the high priest, as we see referenced in Zechariah about Yehoshua ben Yotzadak, he's an anointed one. From this period of time, there arose a concept which we do not find much of in later Jewish literature. From this period, of course, we discuss the coming of Mashiach, and we know Mashiach ben David. From this period of time, there arose a concept known as the suffering Mashiach, Mashiach ben Yosef, who is not ben David, is a second individual. But yet there was a third. We don't find much reference to him, other than a very, very obscure reference in the Gemara Masechet Moed Katan about the Kohen Tzedek. Some refer to as Eliyahu Navi, but in other literature, he's referred to as Mashiach ben Aharon, or if you will, the priest Messiah. Some interpreted this to be a reference to the Maccabees, because indeed the Maccabees, Kohanim as they were, saved the Jewish people and fought. But yet even they made wrong decisions, which brought about their own demise. Anatoxus from the north, the small horn grew to challenge to remove the daily sacrifice from the Holy Temple. And a time will be given for the daily sacrifice because of transgression. And it will cast the truth to the earth, and it will do and prosper. And then I heard one Holy One speaking, and a Holy One said to another one who was speaking, how long will the vision of the daily sacrifice and this abomination be permitted, the sanctuary and the hosts to be trampled? And he said, until evening and morning, 2,300. This 2,300 number is subject again to number of different interpretations. Was it 2,300 specific sacrifices that were missed? Were they 2,300 individual days? No one, again, seems to know the specifics in detail. But I would suggest that possibly all of them are correct. And after this time, it says, the holy ones shall be exonerated. We see here that which was to come was ordained to come. You see, the entire period of the Second Temple was ordained by God for the Jewish people to atone for the sins of the time of the First Temple. Now, I'll elaborate on this as we get into the next chapter, into the ninth chapter, because this is discussed there in great detail. But understand now that things come upon us for a reason. The course of human events and the rise and fall of nations was here so ordained then as it is now. It was ordained by heaven that World War II would occur, and that great mighty nations as Germany and Japan would fall, and a small nation like the United States would rise in height. Who knows what is next to happen? Now it came to pass, when I, Daniel, perceived that vision, that I sought understanding. Behold, there stood before me one who appeared like a man, a malach, a tali, a watcher. And I heard the voice of a man in the midst of the ulai, and he called and said, Gavriel, enable this one to understand the vision. And Gavriel, the malach, Gabriel the angel, came to Daniel and enabled him to understand the vision. How he did so, we don't know. But somehow, what Daniel was receiving in his dreamlike state, not only was he able to remember, he was able to interpret. 17th Pasuk continues and says, and he came up beside the palace where I was standing in his vision. And when he came, I became frightened, and I fell upon my face. And then he said to me, understand, son of man, refers to him as a human, because Gavriel is not. The vision refers to the time of the end. That's curious. Now when he spoke to me, I fell into a sound sleep upon my face to the ground, and he touched me and stood me up where I had been standing, and somehow penetrated his mind to give him insight. And he said to me, behold, I am letting you know what will be at the end of the fury, for it is the end of the time. The ram you saw, the one with the horns, represents the king of Media and Persia. He goat, king of Greece. The great horn that is between his eyes, that is the first king, Alexander. And the broken one, in whose stead stood four, represents four kingdoms that will rise from a nation, but not with its strength. And at the end of their kingdom, when the transgressors have been destroyed, there will arise a brazen-faced king who understands riddles. His power will become strong, but not through his strength. He will destroy wondrously, and he will prosper and accomplish, and he will destroy the mighty and the people of the holy ones. And through his intellect, he will cause the deceit in his hands to prosper, and his heart he will become proud. And in tranquility he will destroy many, and over the prince of princes he will stand. Without strength he will be broken. And the vision of the evening and in the morning that was said is true. Close up the vision, which will be for many days. And I, Daniel, became broken and ill for days. But I rose and did the king's work. And I was terrified about the vision, but no one realized it. Gavriel is telling him that this is the end of days.
This concludes this recording. Please go to the next one now.